Last year, the United States sold $25.7 billion more food than it brought in. This year, that surplus in food trade is expected to decline 62% to only $9.7 billion. This epic collapse in the balance of our food trade leads us to ask, why is the U.S. losing its food trade mojo?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1064th edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Luganville who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Jason Strubia on the boards. Hello, Jason.
Greetings.
Jason, I have a question for you.
Fire away.
What would your future look like if forever, for every $2.25 you earned, you spent $2.75?
It would look indebted.
It would look indebted, would not?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, folks, that's pretty much what the United States of America is doing right now. For every $2.23 million in stuff we sell to the world, we're buying $2.7 trillion worth of stuff. So we are looking, as Jason Strubia, the engineer here, would say, a little bit indebted. You know, folks, the America the Beautiful is, by any means, God's gift to the business of growing food. From sea to shining sea, there is simply no geography anywhere in the world that can match the United States for pure potential to grow food. Yet, in spite of this potential, the United States appears to be in the midst of an epic collapse in its balance of food trade with other nations. Oh, come on, you say. Well, get this. Last year, 2015, the U.S. sold $25.7 billion more food than it brought in. This year, the United States only sold $9.7 billion more than it brought. Ladies and gentlemen, when one's income collapses 62% in 1 year, it's enough to make one sit up and take notice. And so today, we are sitting up and taking notice, and we're going to ask, why is a nation so rich in the potential to grow food losing its food trade mojo? And here to help us out, we have Michael Stumo, who is the CEO for the Coalition for a Prosperous America. Michael, thanks for coming back to the Food Chain.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you know, it wasn't all that long ago. I think it was maybe half a year or so ago, number 1039, and it's 1064 now, we talked about mandatory country of origin labeling. The consumers of the United States wanted to know where their food was made, and so we passed a bill, but what the heck happened?
Well, we have the World Trade Organization Tribunal that went out. They ruled that our country of origin labeling law passed by Congress violated World Trade Organization rules. A couple of concerns there. We didn't realize we were giving away so much sovereignty with international tribunals overruling our law. And secondly, country of origin labeling isn't even dealt with in the WTO agreement. They came up with brand new law out of their heads to strike it down. So, but it allows the multinationals to bring in a lot of imported questionable quality food and displace American produced food.
So in spite of our law, the World Trade Organization made their own law that said our law was no good, and therefore you can't know where your food comes from, and there you are. I guess that's where we're at, right?
That's where we're at. It's just another piece in this whole collapse of our agricultural trade performance, because this whole trade regime is designed to facilitate imports from other countries and to displace American farmers who are making money off of this, you know, U.S. market supplying food to, you know, U.S. citizens.
Well, you know, sometimes as the producer and host of this radio show, I think of myself as a big fat trout laying at the bottom of the stream watching bugs float past. And one of the bugs that floated past here very recently was a press release from the Coalition for a Prosperous America. By the way, what is a Coalition for Prosperous America?
We are a coalition of agriculture, manufacturing, and organized labor, ideologically from the right to the left. It's kind of a Star Wars bar scene, but we all agree that our trade policy is killing our country and we need to fix it. So it's not a, it doesn't, the trade issue doesn't cut across, it cuts across to traditional party lines.
Well, yeah. Who pays for you?
Our members and our supporters.
Okay, so anybody can support you, I guess, then, right?
Yeah, we have companies, we have trade associations, we have farms and ranches, and we have individuals that are our members. And well, we work in D.C. and we work in the country to get, you know, folks aware of our trade deficit problems and the need to fix it so we can grow again in agriculture and manufacturing.
Well, who's on the other side of the backyard fence throwing apples at you?
Well, in agriculture, it's the big commodity groups from the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, National Pork Producers, and the Farm Bureau. In manufacturing and general business, it's the crony capitalists, it's the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the Business Roundtable, National Association of Manufacturers, Club for Growth, and the like.
Mm-hmm. So those are folks that don't want to see any borders, essentially, right?
Yeah, they want a borderless world. Borders are an irritation. And, you know, they work for their multinationals, which is arbitrage labor and regulations, so they can, you know, buy or produce where it's the cheapest and then resell to the wealthiest consumer market in the world, which is the U.S. Mm-hmm. But it's not very good for U.S. producers.
Well, okay, back to this big fat bug that's floating past the stream under this trout, looking up there going, here's something that's very interesting. A press release from the... from your organization, Coalition for a Prosperous America, and it said, and I quote, government report, agricultural trade balance worsens by 62% from last year, despite trade agreements. Now, you know, when one's income goes down 62% in one year, that's like enough to make you sit up and take notice. What in the heck is going on with agriculture? It's the one of the few things we have left here in the United States.
Yeah, you have the USDA and the major commodity groups distracting us with export opportunities with the trade agreements. They say, well, we're going to open up export opportunities to this country or that one. Two things. Number one, the core metric is net trade. Do you sell more than you buy, and by how much, and what is that trend? But they just look at the export opportunities. And secondly, a lot of the export opportunities are to places and people that aren't consumers in the traditional sense. They just don't make enough money. And farmers in the U.S., they sell to U.S. They don't export. It's agribusiness that exports. So these are vampire trade agreements. They facilitate imports and they suck the lifeblood out of the U.S. agricultural economy.
Okay, so, boy, it's hard to imagine, but going down 62% in just 1 year, that seems like a spectacular, epic collapse in our ability to compete in the world. Am I wrong?
Yeah, it's, you know, there's two things going on here. There's volume and price. I mean, our volume, for example, in beef, our beef volume has really dropped in terms of the net trade. I mean, but in another case, it's price, because a lot of our commodity crops that we export are priced lower than last year just because of general price levels. So some of it is just price drop making that dollar difference, and part of it is a volume drop. So as we do the trade agreements, other countries gear up over time to focus on exporting to wealthy consumers in the U.S., and it takes a while for that to take effect. but it's taking effect more and more as they, you know, sort of ramp up. So we see, you know, specialty crops like apples, pears, apricots, cherries, peaches, blueberries, and the like. You know, the things we really, you know, people eat.
Right.
Performing poorly there. And then the food and fiber, we're performing poorly. In fact, the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, we're projected to do far worse in corn and wheat than we would without a TPP.
Well, we're going to
still push it.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, folks. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. We're talking today about our ability to compete in the world and what appears to be an epic collapse in our ability to compete with food, which has always been our traditional strength, given the God-given geography that we enjoy here in the United States. No place on earth comes close to what we have for productivity potential. Do stay tuned. Right back.
Wow, MetroFarm.com says we can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
And we don't even have to own the land. We can lease it year to year.
MetroFarm.com says we can grow fruit on prairie bench lands, houseplants in coastal valleys, vegetables in city greenbelts, and ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
We can even grow flowers on our wooded hillside.
Get all the information you need to grow for profit at MetroFarm.com, including the complete guide to earning 5-, 6-, and 7-figure incomes by farming small parcels of land. Meet the farmers who earn the money. Find experts at MetroFarm.com who will examine your property and assess which crops to grow. Meet consultants who will help steer your project to profitability. And get the latest news about the business of growing high-value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
We've always dreamed about farming a small parcel of land. At MetroFarm.com, we can get all the help we need to stop dreaming and start growing.
Well, folks, we have about just about everything we need to be the most productive country in the world for food. We have it all. We have the natural resources from sea to shining sea, America the beautiful. Oh, my goodness. Where else can you see that incredible geography like we have here? We have the technology. This week I attended Forbes Ag Tech conference, bringing out all the new technology, and it's all there. We have the infrastructure. We have the roads. We have the highways. We have the airports and the rail system. We have all the infrastructure, and we have the markets. We have all the cash to buy everything, and yet, in spite of having all of these things, we seem to be losing our ability to compete with food. Our balance of trade is still in the positive, though it declined 62% last year alone, and that according to a government report, and highlighted by the folks at a Coalition for Prosperous America. And with us today, we have Mark Stumo, who's the CEO of Coalition for Prosperous America. Mark, you must have all the big boys and all the big money up against you, do you not?
We do, but we are seeing now with our horrible trade performance that some of the bigger American businesses are now getting off the free trade bandwagon and joining us too. And that's why one reason you see the country turning against the trade deals in this presidential election.
Well, you know, free trade is one thing, but we were talking earlier about the World Trade Organization ruling against our ability to know from where our food comes from. And that doesn't seem like free trade at all. It's that we are not allowed to know where our food comes from. That sounds like restricted trade to me.
It's restricted. It's crony capitalist trade. It's, you know, it's multinational globalist trade, and it restricts, you know, it frankly shows how our sovereignty is restricted by these deals, because these deals restrict what we can get democratically passed through Congress, and those tribunals are stronger than the Supreme Court. There's no review.
So there, I kind of gives a good reason why the UK took the Brexit, I guess, does it not? If they're ruled by somebody who supersedes your own government, you're kind of toast. Let's go through some terms here to help us understand. First of all, we hear a lot about free trade. What is free trade?
Well, There is no free trade, but the free, I mean, you just, there just isn't. There's, every country games the system, and the free traders pretend that if you cut tariffs, you get rid of countries gaming the system. But what we found is that as the U.S. cuts tariffs, other countries do too, but then they put up other barriers and they subsidize their production to penetrate our market. And it's not free trade. It's not sort of free market supply and demand stuff. So it's a fiction. But, you know, the economists will say you cut tariffs and you get free trade. It just doesn't happen to be true.
Well, so free trade is not, right? It's like cheap food isn't. Free trade isn't either.
Right. Other countries manipulate currency. They will build up, you know, China decimated the U.S. apple industry by massively funding state-supported apple orchards that just sort of took out our industry. And so tariffs don't have anything to do with it. But it's rigged trade, and the multinationals just try to, you know, use it to offshore production.
So we can have free trade, but if your competition's government is subsidizing one industry and your government is not, then it's not going to be very fair trade. What is fair trade?
Well, you know, fair trade, I guess typically people think of good and labor and environmental provisions. You know, I don't know if there's a great definition. I like to think of balanced trade because you want to have a relative balance of exports and imports. You know, China is growing off the back of the U.S. consumer with a massive export-oriented, you know, sort of strategy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we'd like to be a net exporter all the time, but someone's got to be the net importer. So then we would be growing on the backs of someone else's consumer, which would be kind of okay for a while because it's been the other way.
Yeah.
But you want to have balanced trade, and that's really the freest, where you have a relative balance every year, some years of surplus and some years of deficit, but overall balance.
Mm-hmm. Well, if we had a balanced trade, it would be a balanced world then, would it not?
It would. I mean, every country should have some balance, because if you're a net importer like we are overall, of course, agriculture, we have a little bit of a net export, but overall we're a big net importer, and you have a massive drain year after year from your economy, from your production, and from your wealth. And that's why we can't recover from the Great Recession, because we're not producing the stuff that our people need, someone else is, and the money's draining overseas on net.
So, okay, here we are in an election year, and politicians are promising a lot of free stuff, but we're not in a situation where we have a surplus of anything, so we don't have free stuff. So where are we getting, this is, I guess, a kind of a parenthetical question, but where are we getting all the money for these politicians to be promising and giving away free stuff if we're in a situation where we're living in a deficit?
If we could, well, we're not. We're not. And there's really nothing the politicians can do to help grow the economy that unless they balance trade. If we balance trade and don't have $500 or $600 billion trade deficit, if we got rid of that, that would mean we're producing more for our country and other countries. It would be, you know, 2 to 5 million more jobs, plus the income tax revenue from that. It'd be about 2% more growth per year. And then we, you know, then we could recover and we could, you know, get free stuff because we're actually earning it. But we're seeing this year the trade issue is bigger than it's ever been before. And you talked about Brexit. There is some sort of a realignment. We'll see if it sticks between the globalists and, you know, sort of a nationalism. And there's an ugly nationalism and there's an irrational nationalism where borders actually matter, but you're actually nice to people, too.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what Brexit was about. Borders, do borders matter or not? We don't do immigration, but obviously immigration was a big part of it. But free flow of trade and goods, trade and services. So we're seeing, instead of the Republicans and Democrats, high tax, low tax, big government, small government, you had Bernie and Trump and Hillary, which is sort of a global versus national view of things. that's a realignment. We'll see if that sticks, but that's what we're seeing in other countries like Austria, the Philippines, Britain, Denmark, and the like, that this free trade stuff, they said it was win-win, and it's not true, and we're not going to take it anymore.
Yeah, there you go. But my question being, you know, we have a current deficit of some $20 trillion, and yet, you know, the politicians are promising free stuff. And I'm just curious where they get the money, because we don't have it, and we're given our deficit spending, you know, we're far from getting it. So to get that money to give free stuff to people, they must get it from someplace, and I just don't know where they're getting it.
Yeah, they can't get it unless we, you know, if we fix the trade deficit and our agricultural production supplies more of our country and our manufacturing production does too, and then we export more too, then we're actually earning our way again. We can build our roads, we can fund our schools, we can, you know, fund our health care or whatever. But until we do that, it's very hard. So trade is really a core issue that I, you know, that we...
Yeah, it's how we earn our living, right? Yeah. It's how we get by in the world. It's how we earn a salary. Well, folks, that is the question today. What is happening to our ability to earn a salary as a country? We're asking that question with Michael Stumo, who is the CEO of the Coalition for a Prosperous America. And we're going to take a quick break. But when we come back, we're going to ask Michael about how we get to a balanced trade. Do we do it via trade agreements with other countries, agreements like GATT, NAFTA, TPP? What have those agreements brought us that we need? Right back. Well, folks, here are the numbers. For every $2.25 we as a nation earn, we spend $2.75 per op. So, we've been doing that for a long, long time. And as a consequence, we're $20 trillion in the hole. We owe $20 trillion. Now, of course, we're not going to pay it back. We're going to foist it off on our children and our grandchildren and our great-great-grandchildren. To heck with them. They can't say anything about what we're doing, so let's hand it to them and run like hell. That's the situation we find ourselves in, but how do we get out of it? Well, we could strive for some balanced trade, whereas we spend $2.50 and we sell and we earn $2.50. That would be the ideal, I would think. But to get there, how do we do that? How do we affect that? Well, how about if we enter into some trade agreements like GATT to NAFTA and TPP? Surely those people who negotiate those agreements on our behalf are thinking of our best interests, right, Michael Stumo?
Well, they're not, of course. They're misguided, and those agreements have sent us in the wrong direction where we import more than we export, we spend more than we earn. So they do not negotiate for the purpose of getting balanced trade or a net export, unfortunately.
But why? I mean, there are folks, there are people, there are team. What are they? Why not? Why would they not negotiate for us?
Well, their goal, I mean, ultimately we need a national goal, statutory, of balanced trade, and we don't have it. The statutory scheme is that, well, we just need to cut tariff and non-tariff barriers and expand export opportunities, which they claim to do in these deals, and so they'll cut tariffs on socks or something else, but other countries will do currency manipulation or do some tax things or do subsidies. Plus the fact is you just throw U.S. workers into competition with Chinese or Vietnamese or Chilean workers, and you sort of bring the wage level, you know, you bring the wage level to the middle, which means a hike for them, less for us, and it means the multinationals take advantage of it. So it ends up the whole dynamic is a vampire trade agreement sucking the life out of our economy. If you get to balanced trade, it's a very different dynamic.
Well, it would seem to me, being a naive Montana boy, that the United States is the high-cost producer of just about everything. Our labor costs are through the roof. Our environmental costs are through the roof. All of our costs are through the roof. So when we set up a free trade agreement with somebody who, like China, who has an abundant source of labor and no restrictions on what you can do to the environment, it would seem like it would be very cheap there to produce things that we would be very expensive to produce here in the United States. So though that trade might be free, it doesn't seem like it's fair.
The biggest net, the best trade performing country in the world is actually Germany, even more than China. Germany has labor and regulatory costs far higher than us. They're highly unionized, high quality, high tech, you know, kind of, this is more manufacturing side. They don't have a China offshoring problem. They don't have a Bangladesh offshoring problem. They're the biggest net exporter. They sell more and import less. That, you know, in relation to their economic size, they're the best performer in the world. And that's because they focus on jobs and income and wealth creation in their country. They could just focus on getting the lowest cost goods anywhere, but that, we found, is destructive. Also think about when we were a new country, we could have bought, our founding fathers could have said, well, Europe produces stuff cheaper than us, so let's not build our own industry. Let's just build, let's just buy stuff from Europe. Well, they didn't do that. They decided to build our economy, a diverse agricultural and industrial economy to produce, and it was more expensive to do it, but we put people to work, and actually you get an income that is sufficient to pay. So you get more money by having a good income, good jobs, and good wages than you lose by foregoing the cheapest consumer goods on the planet.
So you're not of the opinion that free trade is very good for an economy. I guess it is if you're the low-cost producer in a high-cost world. You're a winner. But if you're the high-cost producer, you're a loser.
Yeah, you really are. I mean, number one, I would argue free trade doesn't exist and it can't exist because of so many differences in among economies and the like. But, yeah, free trade, and I don't think it's even good for countries like Mexico. Ended up having a higher trade surplus with us after NAFTA. We lost on the trade balance terms from Mexico, but it hasn't been good for Mexico. It's good for the multinationals, and we displaced a lot of Mexican farmers who are, you know, and ruined a lot of their domestic economy, so they migrate north, you know, and then the drug trade took effect. Every country, not just us, should focus on building a diverse economy with a solid infrastructure to put people to work so they can have income and trade where it works. It's not an anti-trade position, but the focus is on building your own economy.
You know, that sounds so
what every country needs to do.
That sounds so Jeffersonian, so Thomas Jefferson, you know. It all starts on everybody's farm. And if you take care of building your own farm, then you can begin working with other people. Balanced trade. We have these wonderful trade agreements, but they don't seem to be working out. And the reason they're not working out is why?
Because they facilitate a lot of imports, and they don't facilitate many exports. And so they facilitate trade imbalances and offshoring. They're negotiated. You say free trade on the front, but they're negotiated by... but from input with, you know, the biggest corporations in the country who are just looking out for their own interests, which often is offshoring and producing elsewhere.
Right.
So the 5,500 pages in TPP, it may say kind of free trade and export opportunity on the front, but you read the fine print and it's rigged for somebody else, not us.
So essentially what you seem to be saying is that those who are big enough and have the economies of scale sufficient to be able to influence the government, tell the government that what they want is free trade so that they can make things where it's really cheap and sell it to people where it's really expensive.
Right.
Yeah. We'll make it in China and sell it in the U.S. and, we'll make a lot of money in that transaction. When we have free trade, you say that we reduce the tariffs to little or nothing. But then what happens?
Well, Yeah, so what happens is, I mean, other countries and then the U.S. multinationals take advantage of it. But when China devalues its renminbi or its yuan by 40%, that's like putting up a 40% tariff for U.S. goods and a 40% subsidy for their shipments to us. So if you knock 10 points of tariff off, we get 40 points of currency manipulation. You just lost by 30 points and your economy is bad. That's what happens with Japan, too.
Yeah, when we take a quick break, but when we come back, I'd like to pick up that currency manipulation because we're hearing a lot about it these days. How do countries use currency to set up tariffs and like they have against U.S. products? This is The Food Chain, Michael Olson. Today we're talking about our balance of trade. Michael Stumo, Coalition for a Prosperous America, and you will go to the phones right back. Well, folks, this from the Coalition for a Prosperous America. The U.S. has the worst trade performance in the history of the world, running trade deficits for 40 years in a row. The U.S. trade deficit is a bigger problem than our government budget deficit. In the last decade, the trade deficit reduced U.S. GDP by 3 to 5.5% each year. Millions of good-paying jobs, tens of thousands of companies, and scores of otherwise competitive industry supply chains have been lost as a result. The U.S. needs to produce more of what it consumes, address foreign trade cheating, and eliminate the trade deficit. You know, in watching what's going on in Washington, D.C. right now, Michael Stumo, what I see is half the Republican Party saying yes to that and half saying no to that, and half the Democratic Party saying yes to that and half the Democratic Party saying no to that. Am I wrong?
Yeah, that's about right. In the House, more of the Democrats are with us, and, you know, about a third of the Republicans. The Senate, more of the Republicans and Democrats are against us. Of course, Obama's against us. Trump and Bernie Sanders are kind of for us, and Hillary, we're not sure. So it's a real hodgepodge mix. But certainly the wind is at our back right now, and people are not buying what they're selling.
Okay, folks, we're going to go to the phones really quickly. You're going to pick up Steve. Steve, are you on the line there?
Yes, I am.
Welcome aboard.
Thank you for taking my call. Thank you, and I thank you, guests, for being on. Hey, I wanted to ask if the guests can make a distinction between free trade and free market, as Ron Paul and some other libertarians have, are proponents for. Do you think it's possible that they... politicians are using free trade to confuse the general populace from free market? If the guests could elaborate on the distinction between those two terminologies.
Good question, and thank you for making it here on The Food Chain. Well, free trade versus free markets, Michael.
Well, I think we need another hour.
But at least.
That's the whole thing. Free trade, free markets, free enterprise. How can you be against any of that? You're against freedom, right? So
right.
It's sloganeering. Wonk alert, I might get a little wonky here, but the only place you can have, free markets are part of markets are created and regulated by the government. So there's always an interaction between, stocks don't exist except government says they do. Stock markets don't exist unless government says they do. So you've always got that interaction. I think you can only have free trade among, for example, the 50 states. And why? Because we have the same currency, the same fiscal policy, taxing and the like. We have relatively the same regulation. Same currency, I believe. When you have tried to get free trade among disparate economies that have different currencies, different labor markets, different regulatory regimes, different fiscal systems, that doesn't work. That's what the EU is finding out. They have a currency union and a free movement of people union, but not other stuff, and so you get a lot of imbalances. So what does that mean? It means that if you just think that cutting tariffs gets you to free trade, other countries can do things with their fiscal policy, like subsidize companies, like change their taxes so they give tax rebates as a subsidy for export. They can devalue their currencies, which mimics tariff replacements and subsidy replacements. They can do things with their, you know, their regulation. Their labor market is so different that it doesn't make sense, that it causes more harm than good. So you can have free markets and free trade within a nation state, within borders, where you have all the policy tools necessary to build a successful country. But to try to use tariff cuts to get to free trade is it's a myth. So you might have wanted a bumper sticker, but I can't do that.
Well, you know what? That's an excellent presentation, because that really helps me understand why Europe isn't working and why the United States does work. It's because we have the same set of laws, and Europe has, you know, though it's a coalition, if you will, of nations, they're not all under the same standard. Let's go to Mary, who has a question about enough people being left to work. Mary, welcome to the food chain. Go ahead.
Good morning. I think that all of these rules and regulations and policies and agreements have, in all effectiveness, turned our country into a welfare state. And that welfare state just keeps growing and growing, to the point where nearly 40% of us don't work, because it's much more expedient and productive for us to sit and take, you know, food stamps, unemployment, and all of the welfare. And so my question for your guest is this: do we have enough working force left in the United States to actually turn the country around and to produce again?
Woo!
I'll take my answer on the air.
Thank you, Mary. We're going to have to take a quick break, so we'll pick up that one when we come back. What do you think, folks out there? Do we have enough labor left in the United States? Do we have enough labor to compete now? Do we have enough intelligent labor? Do we have enough technology labor? Or are we in a fix in that respect? This is the Food Chain, Michael Olson with Michael Stumo, Coalition for a Prosperous America. And don't we all want a prosperous America? We will be right back, 831-479-1080 on the Food Chain. Don't you dare touch that dial. Well, Mary asked an interesting question. Do we have enough labor, intelligent labor, left to be competitive in the world again? But this from the Coalition for a Prosperous America. 40 years of persistent U.S. trade deficits have deindustrialized our country, destroyed hundreds of millions of jobs, undercut our innovation capacity, and created trillions of dollars in foreign debt. Whoa, I don't know, it sounds to me like we might have trouble with respect to what Mary suggests. Is there enough, can we supply the labor now, Michael?
Just editorial question, rather than losing hundreds of millions of jobs, more like millions, like 5 million, but just a quick correction. So we do. Mary made the point about food stamps and welfare and the like, which sort of supports the point that we have a labor participation rate, the proportion of our populace that is engaged in the labor force, is at a modern decade low, at about 62.5% to 63%, as opposed to around 66%.
93 million working age Americans out of the labor force, I read somewhere.
Yeah, I don't know the absolute number. I just looked up the participation rate, but we have unemployed, we have underemployed. So there's a bunch of people that could come back into the workforce if we produced more. As to the overregulation point, I think the regulation is more of an irritation than a cost difference, because if you look at the regulatory burden surveys across the developed world, we're about the least regulated. If you go to Germany, which is a high performer, or Spain, or even China, which is a pretty high performer in trade, the regulation is pretty onerous. So some of the regulations are stupid. They should go away, but they're not as big a macro thing for purposes of our discussion as folks, you know, would otherwise assume.
So what's the biggest obstacle?
Well, when you have, I mean, look, when you talk about our trade deficit, China is 320, is half of it, $320 billion. And with a 40, you know, they cut their currency and they have 60% of their economy is state owned, and they subsidize these state owned, you know, international players to penetrate, our market. And that wasn't the case before they joined the WTO, but they geared up to do it. And then we have Japan, Vietnam, Mexico, and South Korea are the other big ones that are driving our trade deficit. It's because they have government and industrial strategies to grow on the backs of the U.S. consumer. And there's 100 tools they use to do it. And our problem is we're still in kindergarten thinking that free trade involves tariffs, and they're in graduate school, and we haven't figured out that we're in a trade war. While Hillary says, oh, we don't want to start a trade war, we're in one, so you have to play to win. And so you figure out which tools can we use to get to balance, to offset, and to bring us closer to free trade, really. And
why have we been so naive?
Because GE makes a lot of money from it.
Because we're being paid to be naive.
Right, and the U.S. trade representatives who do the negotiation are in a job. They don't get paid a lot, but their payday is when they leave the administration and go to work for GE. And go to work for the U.S. Chamber.
And there it is. Michael Stumo, CEO of the Coalition for a Prosperous America. Folks, what can be done to regain our food trade mojo? Remember, Michael, since, what is it? We'll go for the second law of the food chain today. The farther we go from the source of our food, the less control we have over what's in that food. Thank you all for tuning in. Stay tuned next week for more What's Eating What Radio right here on the Food Chain. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
Been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.